as well as dip and soup mixes. The market is open at the Rohde Center for the Arts from 10 until 2.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, the Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network invites you to a free rain garden workshop Tuesday, January 23rd from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Franklin Public Library. Get more information or register online at respectourwaters.org.
This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, Chuck Wolbers, a special education teacher with Kenosha Unified Successful Transitions for Exceptional Students Program, and Steve Brown, assistant professor of educational leadership at UW Oshkosh. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
And good morning, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Education Matters here on WGTD HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. I'm your host today, Steve Brown, and we are recording this program on Saturday, the 13th of January of 2018. And I mention that for a particular reason, that it was 30 years ago to the date that one of the most important landmark U.S. Supreme Court cases was decided, and that's the case of the Hazelwood School District versus Colmeyer. And if you want to look it up if you want to do a Google search, it's a U.S. Supreme Court case 484 U.S. 260, and it was decided on January 13th of 1988. And I am very pleased to have as my guest here on Education Matters, Kathy Colmeyer Frye, who was the person after whom this case is named. And also joining us is Professor Dan Weddle, who's professor of law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. And I'll talk more about how the three of us initially got together and have done some work. Anyway, first of all, Kathy, congratulations on this being the 30th anniversary to the date of your case, even though this program will air next week on the 20th.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having us.
And Kathy, just out of curiosity, when you woke up this morning with this being the 13th of January of 2018, 30 years later, did it feel any different to you?
A little bit. I still wish that the outcome was different. So I think every day that, you know, or every anniversary of it, something that weighs on my mind of how it affected people across the country.
Let me also introduce formally Dan Weddle, who's professor of law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Dan, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, Steve.
Let me ask you this, Dan. As you look at this particular case of Hazelwood, and when you talk about it in any of your law courses that you teach at UMKC, how important has this case been in the overall framework with respect to First Amendment rights of students in our public schools?
Well, I think it's a very important case because it gives a great deal of control over content in school-sponsored publications, school-sponsored theatrical performances, et cetera. I'm a little torn because I'm a fairly staunch advocate of First Amendment rights and making sure that students growing up in our public schools are well acquainted with what their rights are and are prepared to exercise those rights without governmental interference as they enter adulthood. On the other hand, I'm a former school administrator, and so I'm somewhat sympathetic to that concern that that something students say that bears the imprimatur of the school might be might be inappropriate for the school. So I find myself sympathetic to the rationale in of the majority in Kollmeyer, but I'm also disturbed and cautioned by the minority's position, which suggests that this could be used to abuse student expression because the school can the school can certainly be encouraged to believe that it can censor anything with which it disagrees in a school-sponsored publication or some other forum. That's not what the court held. The court says there needs to be a legitimate pedagogical reason for censoring school-sponsored student expression. That does leave a lot of play for heavy-handed administrators who simply don't want a controversial statement out there that could be attributed to the school.
Just for our audience's background, and I'm just going to read a bit of the background, but then, Kathy, I'm going to turn it over to you because you lived this. You were obviously very actively involved in all this, but I'll just give some very basic background, and then I'm going to turn it over to you, and I'll ask you a very direct question about exactly what happened and basically, you know, have you go through step by step, piece by piece, if you will. But anyway, on this day in 1988, on this date, I should say, January 13th of 1988, the U.S. Supreme Court decided in the case of Hazelwood School District versus Kollmeyer. And by the way, for our audience, the Hazelwood School District is in the suburban area of St. Louis. They held that students do not have a First Amendment right to publish a school newspaper free from school administrator editorial oversight. The Spectrum, which was the school newspaper and still is at Hazelwood East High School in Missouri in a suburb of St. Louis, was written and edited by students. And the actual article was written back in May of 1983. And I'm going to stop right there. Kathy, give us the background of how things, what led up to the actual writing and put together, and putting together, rather, of those articles that dealt with teen pregnancy and divorce that appeared in that issue of the Spectrum back in the spring of 1983. And then also maybe share with us some background of those types of articles that appeared, I think, 5 or 6 years before.
Okay. During my junior year of high school, first semester, we were in class for Journalism 1, and we were learning what it was like to be a journalist. And I was very interested in that because I was a good writer and a good kid all around, and just, you know, I enjoyed the class. So in second semester, we're now official journalists, because we have passed Journalism 1, and we hold elections within the class, and we decide who's going to be hold what position with on the staff. And I was chosen to be the layout editor, so I got to design things because I also had a creative flair, still do. So our staff was, I guess, maybe a little bit different than what the typical previous staffs had been in the most recent years. And we wanted to do some stories that were a little more hard-hitting. We recognized some problems within our school. We had a very large teen pregnancy population and a large student body, but we recognized that that was an issue, and we wanted to identify that and talk about it and maybe change some students' minds. We also did stories on divorce, marriage, runaways, and we got these ideas from our morgue, where 5 to 6 years before that, underneath a different principal, the same story topics were run, but we wanted to put a new spin on it. And so that's exactly what we did. We updated things. We had the permission of our director, our advisor, Mr. Sturgis, and proceeded to do our research on everything. The staff interviewed different girls that were pregnant, three very different cases in point with them. One was excited about the pregnancy, one accepted the responsibility for it, and one thought it was just the worst thing that could possibly happen. And we discussed those things, what it was like for them going through that. We talked to the boyfriend. We talked to the parents. But most importantly, we got consent from everyone involved. So we had signatures to support. Once everything was written up, we went back and said, is this accurate? Did we do a good job? If so, please sign off on it. So we had the students as well as the parent approve what we had written to make sure for accuracy, because we were taught, well, it's important to be an accurate journalist because that's responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Kathy, let me interject with a question. Mr. Sturgis, how long had he been at the school?
Oh, many years. Teacher for quite some time.
Okay. So the role of the advisor, maybe describe for our audience who might not have a direct frame of reference for that. What role did Mr. Sturgis play, and how important was he in guiding all of you in terms of following good journalistic ethics?
He played an important role to us, just to direct us to make sure that we were being fair and accurate, that we covered our sources and responsibly quoted. That was one step further along with the pregnancy story. We also changed the names of everyone in it and left a blurb to start that with, stating that we had changed names because he had taught us well. So he would come back and, check to make sure that we were grammatically correct, that stories were just journalistically good. And he, as far as we know, everything was fine with everything going on with it. We had no idea that there would be a problem, but he did end up leaving, and we hadn't known, I guess being, students, it's not his place to discuss it with us, that there had been some issues between him and the principal, Mr. Reynolds.
So, Kathy, you mentioned that Mr. Sturgis left. You mentioned Mr. Reynolds, and who was a fairly new administrator at the school. Dan, by the way, as you're listening to this, just in general, what does that mean in terms of something having the imprimatur of the school or the school district?
Well, it means that it appears that the school is endorsing and supporting that particular piece of writing. For example, you often see disclaimers on various websites or other publications that the opinions expressed in this article are not necessarily the opinions of the editorial board or of the particular publication.
Mm-hmm.
And that's to allow contradictory opinions. Without making it sound as though, a newspaper itself is preaching the opinion of a George Will or preaching the opinion of a Maureen Dowd,
mm-hmm.
but simply allowing it to be expressed. In a school newspaper, of course, because it's so heavily supervised typically by a journalism teacher, et cetera, the fear is that students and parents will assume that anything published in it is reflective of the position of the school. I'm not sure how realistic that is, but that's the concern. So when it bears the imprimatur of the school, it's the reasonable belief by readers that the school itself is endorsing the point of view.
But Dan, as Kathy was talking about the background, I'm wondering if any questions came to mind for you in terms of something that you might like to ask her.
Actually, it did. Kathy, I was struck by the way the facts are portrayed by the case. And let me read part of it. Reynolds was concerned that a student identified by name in the divorce story had complained that her father, quote, wasn't spending enough time with my mom, my sister, and I, end quote, prior to the divorce, quote, was always out of town on business or out late playing cards with the guys, and always argued about everything with her mother. Reynolds believed that the student's parents should have been given an opportunity to respond to these remarks or to consent to their publication. The court never challenges that characterization, but from what you're describing, it sounds as though, in fact, you did talk to the parents and you did give them an opportunity, certainly to consent to what was said. Can you is there some discrepancy between the facts as presented by the court and the facts as you remember them?
There are. I think that goes back to the representation of Ms. Edwards. The parents were given a form to make sure that they were okay with it. My father was the alcoholic mentioned in the story, and actually before the paper was finalized, that particular name was removed.
Uh-huh.
So they're actually going to press.
Was your dad given the opportunity to respond to what you were saying? Or
he was indeed given an opportunity.
What strikes me here is that the facts as recited, Reynolds believed that students' parents should have been given an opportunity to respond to these remarks or to consent to their publication. The implication is that that had not been done when, in fact, it had. It's an interesting thing about cases many, many times, and we saw this with Morris v. Frederick, that the facts that actually reach the Supreme Court on the record may not be accurately reflective of what actually happened. On the record, the majority may pick and choose, maybe cherry-pick some of their facts. But it's an interesting phenomenon that I don't think most people understand, that the way trials work and the way the record goes up, the court might not actually know the real story. It's only working on what it thinks is the real story.
And I believe that to be very true, and I think that goes back to the presentation from Ms. Edwards that she did not go over all of the facts well. She failed to talk about that the articles had been previously run underneath a different administration. So why was it okay several years before and not now underneath a new principal? She failed to mention that the names had been changed. So those kind of things were important, that maybe that would have made differences had they been presented properly and had she been fully prepared, because throughout the testimony, her trial presentation to the justices, she bumbled her way through the majority of it, and it was a direct reflection on how the justices made their case.
Kathy, let's go back for a minute. You know, the role that Mr. Sturgis played. When Mr. Sturgis left, and I believe he left mid-year or thereabouts, the person who took his place, was this person qualified? That's question one. And what kinds of guidance and support did he give to all of you on the staff of the Spectrum?
Well, there were actually two people that came in. The first was just a substitute teacher that had no journalism background, and she was the one that was actually in the classroom with us day to day, so we had no direction provided from her. The other person they brought in was from another school within the district, and he was a journalism advisor, and they said it was his practice to take the finished articles to the principal for his review before they went to press. Now, based upon what we've been told by Sturgis, that was not ever how things were handled with him. So I think we kind of got off track on how things had been typically handled because of the turnover of advisors, but we had no regular interaction with the other advisors that came in.
Mm-hmm. After these articles were written in 1983, I'm talking about the new articles, if you will, the ones that were part of this court case. What exactly happened? And maybe just talk to us briefly about the sequence of events once those articles were written and they were, for lack of a better term, handed into the new advisor who was there and who then followed his normal procedure that he used at his other school?
So when we finished production of it, they went to the new interim advisor. He took them to Mr. Reynolds, the principal. I guess there was conversation about the issue with Reynolds seeing the name at that point still, and the objections came up of that they disagreed with the stories. The paper went to press minus those two pages, came back the following school day because it started over the weekend. We were to sell the paper on that Monday, and when we got the paper back, it was missing those two pages. No conversation was had with us saying, hey, there was a problem. Here's an opportunity to fix anything that was a concern. The two pages just were never printed. At that time, we went down to talk to Mr. Reynolds and to question where were the other two pages, because that was really the lead of the paper, for better words. And he said that it was not going to be printed, basically because they were all trash and nothing was good journalism about them. He also went on to say that throughout our conversations, we said, you know, what specifically? He said, well, you know, you can't be talking about these kind of things, pregnancy to students. He said, it's too mature for an immature audience. And I questioned him and said, if you're old enough to get pregnant, shouldn't you be old enough to read about it? And that didn't go over particularly well with him. He went on to say that if we did not sell the paper as it stood, then there would not be a senior edition, and that was accolades to the graduating seniors, and there were more seniors in the class than juniors. So he told us we could take a vote and decide, and because of the fact that there were more seniors than juniors, they won out. The paper was sold as it stood. Those of us that were not in favor of it did not participate in selling the paper. We went back up and discussed what our next action plan would be because we felt very strongly about it. I went over into the library where we had an actual phone that we could get in touch with Sturgis, and I made a phone call to Mr. Sturgis, and I told him what had just happened and asked for his opinion of what we needed to do because we felt that after having had Journalism 1, learning about prior restraint, and the Tinker standard, that we had been censored, our rights had been violated. He advised me at that time to contact the American Civil Liberties Union, which I went back to the class and told the ones that were still within the class, this is what Sturgis said. And he was the kind of advisor that you really trusted. The kids had a very good relationship with him, and we believed in everything that the man said to be good. So we went home that night, talked to our parents about it. Those parents that were supportive of it said, fine, do what you guys need to do. Those are the other ones that were concerned about possibly not graduating just because of, you know, it was very near to graduation. They didn't follow through with it, but we, group of us, did go to the ACLU. We did have a conversation with them, and they were in agreement that censorship had occurred, and they decided to follow it and make it a case.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any sense that Mr. Reynolds had actually read the articles?
I had thought so up until that day because he had, you know, made the comment that they were trash. And then during that time at UMKC, when he said that, well, it was all just a budget reason that we didn't have the money for it, and he had never actually read the articles, there was an audible gasp within that entire very large room full of many people. I don't ever honestly to this day know if he read them or not, because he has now talked out of both sides of his mouth.
We've talked about the Tinker decision, which was decided in 1969. And for our listening audience who might recall the conversations that I've had with John Tinker along with Mary Beth Tinker, on previous shows. You know, the Tinker Standard talks about, and that's where the students won with respect to students who were wearing black armbands to protest the Vietnam War, that they had the right to do so as long as it did not cause a material and substantial disruption. That students do have the right of freedom of expression, and those very important words, Dan, and Kathy as well, that students and teachers don't shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate. Dan, when you hear those words, okay, and when you read those words, and you look at how the Hazelwood decision went down, what kinds of thoughts run through your mind, not only as a professor of law, but someone who's been a school administrator?
Well, they are profound words, and I think that they still have much of the strength that they had at the time of Tinker, though they've been weakened in some ways, certainly arguably weakened by subsequent decisions. You have to remember that they don't shed their constitutional rights, but they also hold them within the special characteristics of the school environment. And so even Tinker did not say they were in any sense unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
The difference in Hazelwood was the distinction between school-sponsored speech and private student speech.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things when I teach these cases is to talk about with my students, how do you distinguish between what is school-sponsored student speech and what is private student speech? When is the line crossed? The interesting thing, it seems to me, in this case, and I want to go back to how many of the facts seem not to be correct in the opinion because of perhaps poor lawyering or whatever else happened there. I don't have a real problem with the rule that came from this case, which is that when there's a legitimate pedagogical concern, the school needs to have the freedom to intervene in school-sponsored publications. But I have a real problem with the result of this case, given the facts as Kathy is explaining them, because I'm not sure the result would have come out the same way had the court really understood what the facts were. I don't know that the rule would have been different, but I think the result certainly could have been different. And I'd really like to know, Kathy, what do you think of that? I mean, do you feel that this rule is too much of a blanket license for schools to suppress legitimate student school-sponsored speech?
Very much so. I think they should be looking at more things on a case-by-case basis rather than saying this applies to all and therefore it shall be.
Well, now, what I'm talking about is the rule itself, that if the school has reasonable, legitimate pedagogical concerns about that speech, is that too broad a rule in your opinion?
It is.
How would you rework that rule that would leave it less prone to abuse?
I think I would look at as far as what these subjects were based on, because if you want the students really develop a love for journalism and want to pursue that in life, you have to give them the opportunity to learn within school, within that school environment. And I think there should be some topics that should probably be off limits, but some things, pregnancy being one of them, it happens, and students do have a right to know about it. And it's not like if you want to say something where you're bashing someone, I don't agree with that. I don't think school is the place for that to be. But in these type of articles in particular, where they are informative, they're giving you hotline numbers for runaways, if they are useful things, I think things like that should be given the opportunity to run. I think more the issue that happened within Hazelwood is that because that paper was available to regular people within the community, I think he was trying to hide the fact that Hazelwood East had a pregnancy problem root cause.
You know, let me just step in for a second. In the majority opinion, right towards the end, right in the opinion, I'll just quote this. It says that Principal Reynolds testified credibly at trial that at the time that he reviewed the proofs at the May 13th issue, during an extended telephone conversation with Emerson, he believed that there was no time to make any changes in the articles and that the newspaper had to be printed immediately or not at all. It is true that Reynolds did not verify whether the necessary modifications could still have been made in the articles and that Emerson did not volunteer the information that printing could be delayed until the changes were made. And, you know, and when I read that, and I mean, I read that over like three different times in the last couple of days in preparation for this interview, and knowing, Kathy, what you had said before, and again reiterating what you just said today in this interview, that, you know, here's the principal saying to you that he hadn't even read the articles. So again, Dan, that goes back to what you said, what was or wasn't said in the Eighth Circuit Court in their decision, and what actually happened.
Well, that's exactly right, and I think here what we're seeing is poor presentation at trial, poor presentation of evidence, resulting in a bad result for the parties, and a decision that was based on erroneous facts. By no fault of the Supreme Court itself, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I go back to the question, is this a bad rule? And let me say again, here's what the rule is. Educators do not offend the First Amendment by exercising editorial control over the style and content of student speech and school-sponsored expressive activities so long as their actions are reasonably related to legitimate pedagogical concerns. Now, if you go back up and say, well, what are those? The court lays out these examples, speech that is ungrammatical, poorly written, inadequately researched, biased or prejudiced, vulgar or profane, or unsuitable for immature audiences. I have to say, I don't have a problem if that's what we're talking about as far as legitimate pedagogical concerns. I think from my perspective in this case, the facts that were given the court would fall into those examples. The facts on the ground would not have. And I think that is too bad, is really too bad.
Mm-hmm.
I think this could have been a much more well-informed case and might have fleshed out in better a better explanation of what the rule ought to look like when applied. So we have almost a cartoonish version of what really happened, and that's unfortunate because I think it leaves a lot that might have been said by the court unsaid.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to bring up, and it hasn't been said, but the articles were well written. Everyone on there was
yes.
a very, very good student. We were all very capable of writing, any one of us, those articles, as well as what those particular authors did. But that was never really an issue. They were all good journalistic stories. And ironically, when Reynolds didn't want it to run, didn't want that broadcast out to anyone, the major papers of St. Louis did pick it up and actually run it themselves. So it really backfired upon what his intentions were.
I hadn't known that bit. I'll tell you what I'm getting at here is in the case, one of the examples is articles that are inadequately researched, which the court seems to have believed was the case here, which you're telling us was clearly not the case. So again, I don't have a problem personally with the idea that an inadequately researched article ought not to go out under the school's name. But I think you were cheated here in the facts on the ground,
mm-hmm.
and that was
I would agree with that.
That characterization was unfair, but I'm not sure the court understood that was not an accurate characterization of what had happened. The one part that is a little, and it's consistent with Frazier, is the idea that it's unsuitable for immature audiences. That does give a huge amount of latitude, though I think, and Kathy, I think you said the same thing, there are some things that might be unsuitable. What constitutes unsuitable can very quickly morph into what we object to,
mm-hmm.
some idea we don't want our students to hear.
Let me also say that on the day that the Hazelwood decision came out on January 13th of 1988, on the following day, the court's opinion received headline treatment and a lot of airtime on the three major news networks. It was front page news in the New York Times, the Baltimore Sun, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Washington Post, and USA Today. And many papers after that ran follow-up stories. There were editorials. There were comments and articles written by a number of the journalism organizations, the Columbia Journalism Review, the Washington Journalism Review, the Quill, and others. The final thing I wanted to ask you, Kathy, after 30 years now, as you look back, my two very quick questions for you. Number one, how has this case affected your life? And the second question, what impact has it had on your family?
Well, it's had a large impact on me as far as how I believe things, how I've raised my children. And so I can bring this into one question. But it's given me the opportunity to travel the country, to talk to educators, to talk to students, just people with an interest in journalism, and tell my story about it. But most importantly, it's allowed me to be part of the New Voices Act of USA, to talk to legislatures about how important it is to reconsider this decision. Many states are now passing laws
mm-hmm.
to basically restore the rights to student journalists, and it is a very active movement in the country to get those rights wronged for future students and current students. But it's also made me the kind of person that I will speak up for things that I disagree with. It's also modeled my children into being that type of person as well. Not to the point by any means that we're the rabble-rouser, but, it may just be something so simple as when my son was born, had problems at birth, required a special feeder, that I was not afraid to take on the insurance company telling me that this expensive nipple for his bottle because of a cleft palate was, they said it was unnecessary, but yet he was failure to thrive, and I took them on and I won.
Mm-hmm.
It was best for my child. So it's just little things like that that my kids tell me I'm just kind of scrappy. And you know what? I'll take that any day because it means that I know doesn't have to always be the final answer. You know, there's nice ways that you can go about questioning that and still make a difference. But ultimately, I want to be that one person that can make a difference in our country. And if it's got to be over freedom of press, freedom of speech, then so be it. That will be my soapbox.
Mm-hmm. And as many of our listeners know, the state of Illinois did pass legislation and signed by the governor last year that does give students many more rights of freedom of the press. Obviously, not writing anything, but rather following good journalistic ethics and standards. And there is a move on here in Wisconsin that a number of educators and journalists are supporting. And that's just a question of time, when or if that might happen. Dan, in wrapping things up, from your perspective as a professor of law, former school administrator, parent, and what final comments can you make?
Well, you know, I'm going to say it as a citizen, and that is that Kathy is to be congratulated for all of her efforts, beginning with what happened while she was in high school. We've entered a time where the press is under dangerous attack, and freedom of press is a critical aspect and foundational to the republic. And so I say anybody that's going to fight for freedom of the press and anybody who's going to push for greater freedom is to be championed and applauded. I've told you that I'm not troubled particularly with the rule from Hazelwood, if you take it in its context. I think it's workable, but I am troubled by the way it's often abused by school administrators, in the same way that some of the religion cases were abused by school administrators, and that's always a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So laws that bring greater clarity to what administrators can do and not do are an absolutely welcome addition to this field of law, because I think that administrators are not well-versed, typically, and teachers are not well-versed in what the law actually requires, permits, or forbids. And so anything that can flesh that out for them in more explicit and directive terms, I think, is good. So, Kathy, I hope you keep the fight up, because I think we need it.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate that.
Well, I want to thank both of you, Kathy Kohlmeier-Fry and Dan Weddle. Dan, who's a professor of law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and Kathy Kohlmeier-Fry, who still lives in Missouri, and her case of Hazelwood School District versus Kohlmeier. And this was a landmark court decision of the U.S. Supreme Court that held that public school curriculum student newspapers that have not been established as a forum for student expression are subject to a lower level of First Amendment protection than independent student expression or newspapers established as forums for student expression. That decision was handed down on January 13th of 1988, 30 years to the day that we are recording this, on January 13th of 2018. For Education Matters here on WGTD-HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, I'm your host for Education Matters this morning, Steve Brown. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org. And you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Support comes from Jack Andreas. Enjoy up to 75% off select merchandise and floor fixtures while we ready ourselves for our 2018 Reimagining Remodel. We'll be temporarily closed starting Sunday, January 28th. Visit jackandrea.com for details and schedule pop-up shops around town.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus, honoring personal legacies and the circle of life. Allow the compassionate, caring staff at Piasecki Althaus to take care of your funeral needs, serving the community since 1931.
Support comes from Andrea Ann Orendorf, certified public accountant.